Welcome back to the Counter Vortex with your ranter, Bill Weinberg, ranting at you in the wee hours of May 4th, 2024, as always from my apartment on Manhattan's Lower East Side, which fortunately is not under aerial bombardment. We'll just start with a little recap of this past week's news from the Gaza Strip. As Israel continues to threaten a full-scale assault on Rafah in the southern strip, aid organizations are scrambling to try to prepare to respond to the catastrophic humanitarian impact that a ground invasion is expected to have. Facing a severe scarcity of supplies and resources, those involved in the effort say that whatever preparations they make will undoubtedly fall far short of the needs, if in fact the invasion goes ahead. As we know, nearly 1.5 million Palestinians, 65% of the population of the Gaza Strip, are living in dire conditions in the city of Rafah after being forcibly displaced from other parts of the Strip. And if you think things are bad now, if this Rafah invasion goes ahead, everything is going to get much, much worse. That is evident. Early in the week, there was a glimmer of hope when Foreign Minister Israel Katz said that the Rafah operation could be suspended in the event of a deal with Hamas for release of the hostages. However, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, one of the so-called hardliners in the cabinet, strongly dissented, asserting that the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will have no right to exist, quote-unquote, unless Israel invades Rafah, and threatening to resign if the Rafah invasion were put off. Netanyahu promptly capitulated and said that the ground offensive into Rafah will go ahead regardless of any negotiations, which sort of makes the negotiations in Cairo rather pointless. Satellite photos analyzed by the Associated Press reveal a massive compound of tents being built near Khan Yunis, the next significant town up from Rafah. This is presumably one of the so-called humanitarian islands being prepared by the Israeli military for those displaced by a Rafah invasion. A euphemism, of course, for detention camps or concentration camps. And the Israeli military is intermittently bombarding the outskirts of Rafah more than once over the past week. This despite growing international pressure. Israeli officials told the New York Times April 28th, last Sunday, that they believe the International Criminal Court is preparing to issue warrants for senior government figures in the genocide case that was brought last year by states including Bolivia and Bangladesh. Israeli and foreign officials are also said to believe that the ICC is weighing arrest warrants for Hamas leaders. And meanwhile, Haim Rubinstein, a representative of the hostage advocacy organization Families Forum, told Times of Israel that officials told him that, quote, Hamas had offered on October 9th or 10th to release all the civilian hostages in exchange for the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, not entering the Strip. But the government rejected the offer, end quote. That from the Times of Israel, April 26th, a claim that certainly needs to be looked into. I hope the International Criminal Court is paying attention. Nonetheless, the fact that there has still been no invasion of Rafah, but in fact a big reduction of Israeli ground troops in Gaza, after several weeks now of a threatened imminent invasion, is evidence that international pressure on Netanyahu and the Israeli government is having an impact. And this includes our protest at the grassroots level on the streets and the college campuses around the world. NYPD invaded the Columbia University campus for a second time in the wee hours of May 1st, followed 2 days later by the police evicting a second attempt to establish an encampment at New York University here in my neighborhood, and also a police raid on the encampment at the New School, just a few blocks up Fifth Avenue from NYU, with several arrested at both. At Columbia, one officer apparently discharged his gun while evicting the students from Hamilton Hall. The bullet is apparently still lodged in a wall there, according to media accounts. Also that night, May 1st, the Los Angeles Police Department and California Highway Patrol invaded the UCLA campus. One night after the encampment there was violently attacked by pro-Israel counter-protesters, and as in the unfortunate incident at Columbia University back in January, the Zionist counter-protesters apparently used some kind of chemical irritant on the pro-Palestinian protesters. In the LAPD raid, the cops are reported to have fired what are called non-lethal rounds at the protesters, rubber bullets, which can indeed be lethal if they hit you in a vulnerable place like the eye. And there have also been police raids on encampments at UC Irvine and Humboldt State, or Humboldt Cal Poly, as they are now calling it. However, the encampments are still standing at Stanford, Berkeley, and San Francisco State, according to the latest reports. The police repression has drawn concern from the United Nations Human Rights Office in a statement on April 30th. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, said he is troubled over a series of heavy-handed steps taken to disperse and dismantle protests, quote-unquote, across U.S. college campuses. Quote, freedom of expression and the right to peaceful assembly are fundamental to society, particularly when there is sharp disagreement on major issues, as there are in relation to the conflict in the occupied Palestinian territory and Israel. I am concerned that some of the law enforcement actions across a series of universities appear to be disproportionate in their impacts, unquote. So the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights scolding the United States. That's refreshing. In some good news, there appears to have been a successful resolution at Brown University in Rhode Island, with the protesters agreeing to disband their encampment in return for a pledge from the corporation that runs the university to vote on divestment from Israel. So that's heartening. The protests have also now spread to Europe. Berlin police on April 27th cleared a camp set up in front of the German Parliament building by activists demanding the government stop arms exports to Israel. Now, the protests are absolutely necessary, and those calling for their repression, from Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, to New York City Mayor Eric Adams, to, much to my chagrin, leaders of campus Jewish groups such as Hillel, are to be called out and repudiated in the harshest terms. However, it is also true that there are those among the protesters, at least from what I've personally witnessed here in Manhattan, including at NYU and the New School, who, shall we say, do not entirely have their eye on the ball analytically. I will return to this later in this rant. But first, I want to draw your attention to the protests in Israel, which are not getting nearly as much attention as they deserve in the world media. Families of hostages and their supporters have been rallying regularly for weeks in Tel Aviv and have been repeatedly attacked by the police, most recently on Monday, April 29th, when five were arrested. They are calling for Bibi Netanyahu to resign, accusing him of being more interested in pursuing the war for his own political purposes than in securing the release of the hostages. And they are at least now calling for putting off an invasion of Rafah in the interest of a hostage deal, under the slogan, Rafah can wait, hostages cannot, quote unquote. Now, I certainly wish that they were more forthright in their anti-war position, without a doubt, but it's a start. I'll take what I can get. And okay, you've heard of these reactionary idiot Israelis who have been blocking the roads leading to the Gaza crossings to try to prevent aid from entering amid starvation in the Strip? Well, I hope you also heard about these folks. I'm going to read an account from the JTA, Jewish Telegraphic Agency, of April 26th. Quote, author Ayelet Waldman, six other activists, rabbis, arrested trying to take food into Gaza. Members of the protest action say they didn't expect to succeed, but wanted to highlight the needs of Palestinians. Israeli police on Friday, April 26th, arrested seven rabbis and activists, including Ayelet Waldman, a Jewish-American author, as they tried to cross into the Gaza Strip with a symbolic delivery of food. Waldman, who is Israeli-born, was taking part in a protest action organized by Rabbis for Human Rights and one of five Americans. Two were released before Shabbat, organizers said, but Waldman was still in custody at the police station in Ashkelon, a city near the Gaza border. Her husband, Michael Chabon, also a noted novelist, expressed concern about her status on Instagram. Quote, she was there in the company of a group of American rabbis, Rabbis for Ceasefire. That's hashtag Rabbis, Arabic numeral 4, ceasefire, to show the world, the people of Gaza, and their fellow Jews in Israel and around the world, what Judaism teaches. Justice, loving kindness, peace, mercy, liberation, end quote. In a video Chabon posted, Waldman is seen bearing a bag of rice as she walks towards the Erez crossing on the northern Gaza-Israel border. A policeman blocks her way, and she persists in trying to skirt him. The other Americans arrested included Rabbi Alisa Wise, a founder of Rabbis for Ceasefire, Rabbi Alana Alpert, a Detroit-area congregational rabbi, Ilana Sumka, a longtime activist and rabbinical student, and Kobe Snitz, a mathematician, end quote. Well, that's heartening. As a non-believer, I feel the need to add that I don't know if the Judaism that teaches loving kindness and mercy has any greater claim to authenticity than that of Bezalel Smotrich, but it is certainly preferable. And I read this account into the record because there needs to be much more awareness of these dissident Israeli voices. I am certainly aware of the significant Jewish presence at the protest encampments here in the U.S., but I nonetheless also want to read some excerpts from a piece that appeared in The Forward, April 29th, by one Lihi Ben Shitrit, who writes in the intro deck, quote, I teach Israeli students at NYU. We are importing the worst of Israel and Palestine to our campuses. The campus protests are often adopting some of the most extreme rhetoric from the region. Some excerpts from the text, quote, since the atrocious October 7th attack by Hamas, and the catastrophic response by the Israeli government in Gaza. Too many students, faculty, and community members at U.S. universities have been mimicking the worst kinds of discourses coming out of Israel and Palestine. I have seen those who consider themselves to be on the progressive left and who care about Palestinians parroting ultra-nationalist slogans like "from the river to the sea," excusing violence that amounts to war crimes with the slogan "by any means necessary," and using the word "Zionist" as an expletive. Many of those who care about Israelis proclaim that they are standing with Israel without criticizing the Israeli government's ultra-nationalist policies of occupation and Jewish supremacy, which are the law of the land in Israel-Palestine from the river to the sea. Others have used the label anti-Semitic to describe anything from actual anti-Semitism to mere calls for a ceasefire or denouncements of Israeli violence in Gaza and the West Bank. On the pro-Israel side, calling out of the de facto apartheid that exists in the West Bank or the suffocating siege on Gaza that's been going on for nearly two decades, or even noting that this siege was the context in which October 7th happened, is denounced as anti-Semitic libel. This is a well-used tactic on the Israeli right to silence criticism of its policies. On the pro-Palestinian side, the approach to Israelis as usurpers whose illegitimate national identity must be erased have become all too common. I have sat with students who told me that Israelis should not be considered human because they are settlers. I also spoke with students who told me they were collecting donations for the Israeli Defense Forces at a time when its war effort has led to the killing of thousands of children in the Gaza Strip. End quote. Now, I take issue with some of Ben Shachrit's wording here, which I will return to, but I must agree with her overall point. I note some very bad news this week, which makes the whole intellectual climate much worse. The Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, as it is called, was passed by the House of Representatives on May 1st, which would direct the Department of Education to use the definition of anti-Semitism promulgated by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, when enforcing federal anti-discrimination laws. This extremely problematic, and I'll go so far as to say propagandistic, definition of anti-Semitism explicitly conflates anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. It has already been recognized by a Trump executive order of 2019 that remains in effect, and it is imperative that we aggressively promote the alternative Jerusalem Declaration, drafted by a group of Holocaust historians in 2021, with a more sophisticated and nuanced definition of anti-Semitism, less subject to propagandistic exploitation, as we discussed in our podcast of March 21st, entitled "Blood Libel in a Time of Genocide." Now, some of what is being said on left book, so to speak, about the IHRA definition is not quite accurate. It does not call all criticism of Israel anti-Semitic. That would be a little too blatant. But it does label recognizing the state of Israel as a racist endeavor, quote unquote, as anti-Semitic. So it is more accurate to say that it conflates anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. It very clearly does that. And as an anti-Zionist, I recognize this as extremely dangerous. And I understand the tendency to react to the accusation of anti-Semitism with mere defensiveness instead of examining elements of our own side's behavior that might play into the perception of anti-Semitism among the protesters. Despite the evident reality of many Jews among their ranks. I know, heresy. I want to say a little more about the From the River to the Sea slogan that Ben Shatrit quoted in her essay, and its evolution and various permutations. First, it must be acknowledged that this slogan has rejectionist origins, that it was originally meant by both Hamas and elements of the PLO, the destruction of Israel, and its replacement by a single Palestinian state. In more recent years, it has been taken to mean, by some, a single secular state with equal rights for Arabs and Jews alike. Although the slogan continues to be bandied about without enough discussion about its meaning, and therefore no clear consensus on it. Then, recently, Israeli annexationists have satirized or appropriated the slogan in very ugly manner as From the River to the Sea, Israel is what you'll see. So, literally and blatantly mirroring the Palestinian rejectionism that they claim to oppose. I don't know how they square it. And now, this is something that I witnessed just this past week on a sign at a protest at New York University. Pro-Palestinian maximalists, shall we say, are reversing the perverse Israeli perversion of the slogan as From the River to the Sea, Palestine is all you'll see, seeming to return the slogan to its rejectionist roots. So to me, this pathological dynamic vindicates the basic point made by Ben Shatrit in her essay. I should also make clear where I probably part company with her. There is a legitimate rejectionism, in a certain sense. Rejection of a Jewish state, an ethno-supremacist state for Jews, which is currently what Israel is, and is currently imposing in the occupied territory. So, ironically, a single Jewish de facto ethno-supremacist state from the river to the sea. Rejecting that is legitimate, but I am not making any excuses for rejection of a Jewish presence in Palestine, such as is evidenced in the sometimes heard, ignorant, ahistorical, and offensive slogan, "Go back to Poland," quote unquote, where I will point out there was a firebomb attack on a synagogue in Warsaw this week on May 1st, certainly placing that slogan in a rather ironic light. And it has also been noted that if we take Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza together as a single entity, historic Palestine, if you will, and include the Palestinian refugees in other countries in the immediate region, there are approximately 7 million Jews and 7 million Arab Palestinians. A demographic balance that would be just about right to keep either side from treating the other as a minority. And I want to return again to the nearly forgotten historical figure who we've touched on in some of our recent podcasts, Judah Magnus, the New York rabbi and dissident Zionist, who was a co-founder of Jerusalem's Hebrew University, and an advocate for what he called a binational Arab-Jewish state in Palestine. So, a Zionist in that he called for Jewish colonization and settlement of Palestine, but a dissident Zionist in that he was suspicious, at least, of the notion of a Jewish state. I think in some ways his ideas are more relevant today than they were in his own time, as I will explain. I want to read a couple of quotes from him. First, these all too prophetic words from 1946, when the UN was moving toward partition of Palestine. He stated on behalf of his Ikud, or Unity Party, quote, "We oppose partition, not only for the reasons that are usually given, but because partition is going to mean the intensification of chauvinism on both sides. When you draw these borders, when you draw these frontiers, and have the Jewish schools on one side of the line and the Arab schools on the other side, have you any idea what is going to be taught in them? Well, I have. There is going to be hatred by the Jews of the Arabs, and hatred of the Jews by the Arabs." End quote. Yup. And he wrote in 1930, in defense of his vision of a binational state, quote, "What does Palestine mean for us? What is our Zionism? I can answer for myself. Immigration, settlement on the land, Hebrew life and culture. If you can guarantee these for me, I should be willing to yield the Jewish state and the Jewish majority. I would agree to a legislative assembly together with a democratic political regime so carefully planned and worked out that the above three fundamentals could not be infringed." End quote. Now, you can say that by encouraging Zionist settlement of Palestine, Magnus was complicit with the Jewish state, even as he claimed to reject it. But whatever you want to say retrospectively about Zionist colonization between the 1890s and the 1940s, the Jews are there now. It is a simple demographic reality. The project of Zionist colonization continues in the settlement of the West Bank and the evident plans for a resettlement of Gaza. And that, of course, is to be opposed. But the notion that the 7 million Jews living in historical Palestine are going to go elsewhere is every bit as diluted as the extremist Zionist dream of a Palestine ethnically cleansed of Palestinians and transformed into a greater Israel. So while I have my own ideas about the best way forward, which I've articulated in previous podcasts, toward arriving at a single secular state, ultimately, whether there is to be one state or two, or in the anarchist vision, no state, and regardless of that state's name, Israel, Palestine, or both, or a portmanteau such as Israteen, as has been suggested, the Jews and Palestinians are going to have to find a way to coexist. Now, this necessarily implies justice for the dispossessed Palestinians, and it is by no means an easy prospect, especially after all of the damage that has been done over the past 7 months. But sometimes extreme circumstances can result in political and conceptual breakthroughs and make people realize that there is no alternative to coexistence. As I've said before, and I'm going to continue to repeat until it sinks in, the only alternative to coexistence is Armageddon. Just two more things I want to say before we sign off. First, just as we're waiting for the invasion of Rafah, there is another city that is awaiting invasion with the prospect of genocide looming, El-Fasher, in the Darfur region of Sudan, which is now besieged by the Rapid Support Forces, which is really just a rebranding of the Janjaweed militias that carried out the Darfur genocide. Remember Save Darfur? Well, 15 years later, the genocide is back on. And this time, nobody is even paying attention. It's been completely pushed from the headlines by Gaza. We hope to return to the situation in Darfur in the weeks to come. Urgently needs more of the world's attention. Not instead of Gaza, let me emphasize, obviously, after having spent the past several weeks talking about Gaza. And lastly, much as I am reluctant and find it irksome to engage in self-promotion, I must make an appeal for more support for this podcast, because we lost another Patreon subscriber this week. The number went down from 61 to 60. I was so encouraged that we had finally made it over 60, and now we've lost one. And it occurs to me that if I just engaged in uncritical cheerleading for one side or the other, I could have much greater support and a much bigger audience. If I just said every week, death to the Zionist insect that preys upon the life of the people, or call out the National Guard, clear the Jew-hating protesters. If I were to conform to either one of those lines, I could get an enthusiastic fan club. But it wouldn't be socially useful. And there's enough other folks doing that, God knows. And I find it more useful to ask the tough questions and try to provoke honest grappling. So if you get what we do, please throw us just $1 a week. Not a lot. Patreon.com/countervortex. This has been Bill Weinberg with the Counter Vortex. Check us out online at countervortex.org. Please support us on Patreon. Join the Counter Vortex. Join the resistance. And rant on you next time.